Donald Trump is safe after another apparent assassination attempt.
The local sheriff said the suspect fled, leaving behind an AK-47-style rifle with a scope, a GoPro camera, and two backpacks.
Plus, Israel vows retaliation against Houthis following a missile strike in central Israel.
Israel reported no fatalities or injuries in this weekend's missile strike, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed vengeance while addressing his cabinet.
And later, Ukraine steps up its attacks into western Russia, and in eastern Russia, the Chinese and Russian navies are practicing together. Plus, a look back at the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Today is Monday, September 16th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Donald Trump is safe after what officials say was the second unsuccessful assassination attempt in 2 months. The FBI took the lead after Sunday's shooting with a suspect in custody, and with Americans facing another dramatic event in what is already a high-stakes, high-drama election. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
For the second time in 9 weeks, former President Donald Trump walked away from a would-be assassination. The latest on Sunday afternoon at his golf club in West Palm Beach, Florida, the FBI said. Unlike the previous attempt, this one did not happen on live television, like the dramatic shooting Trump survived on July 13th. That attempt wounded Trump in the ear and killed a rally attendee behind him. Days later, Trump accepted the Republican Party's presidential nomination. Officials on Sunday said Trump was not hurt.
Former President Donald Trump is safe and unharmed.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is leading the investigation, says it appears to be an attempted assassination. The local sheriff said the suspect fled, leaving behind an AK-47-style rifle with a scope, a GoPro camera, and two backpacks. Police later caught him as he sped along the main highway into a neighboring county. Sheriff Rick Bradshaw leads the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office.
The Secret Service agent that was on the course did a fantastic job. What they do is they have an agent that jumps one hole ahead of time to where the president was at. And he was able to spot this rifle barrel sticking out of the fence and immediately engage that individual, at which time the individual took off.
In a joint statement less than an hour after the Trump campaign announced this second attempt on Trump's life, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris said they were being regularly briefed and said they are relieved that Trump is safe. The sheriff said that the suspect was between 300 and 500 yards, about 275 to 460 meters from Trump, hiding in shrubbery. And as Monday dawns and questions swirl in America about how this will add further uncertainty in an already tumultuous election, those simple numbers underscore a terrifying fact. That a shooter managed to get so close to Trump, comfortably within the range of an AK-47-style rifle, about 275 meters. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Speaking on the condition of anonymity, three law enforcement officials tell the Associated Press that the man in custody is Ryan Ruth of Greensboro, North Carolina. In 2020, he made a social media post backing Trump's reelection, but in more recent years, his social media posts have expressed support for Biden and Harris. Ruth tried to recruit Afghan soldiers fleeing the Taliban to fight in Ukraine against the Russians and spent several months in the country, this according to an interview he did with the New York Times last year. Meanwhile, Israel's prime minister vows that his country will exact a heavy price following a missile strike in central Israel. Yemen's Iran-backed Houthis took credit for the attack as the Israel-Hamas conflict continues to spread. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more on the rising tensions in the region.
A small fire burns brush near Modi'in in central Israel. This is the aftermath of a hypersonic ballistic missile launched by the Iran-aligned Houthi rebels in Yemen, more than 2,000 kilometers away. Houthi military spokesperson Brigadier General Yahya Sari on an Ansar Allah media office feed as provided by the Associated Press.
The Israeli enemy should expect more strikes as we approach the first anniversary of the blessed October 7th operation. These include continued support operations for the oppressed Palestinian people.
Sari referencing the October 7th terror attacks carried out by Hamas, in which the group killed 1,200 people in Israel and kidnapped more than 250 others. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed in Israel's counteroffensive in Gaza. Israel reported no fatalities or injuries in this weekend's missile strike, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed vengeance while addressing his cabinet. Netanyahu speaking on a government press office feed as provided by Reuters.
We are in a multi-front campaign against Iran's axis of evil. They should have known by now that we exact a heavy price for every attempt to harm us. Hamas is already learning this through our determined action, which will bring about its destruction and the release of all of our hostages.
Despite his pledge to bring hostages home, many Israelis say Netanyahu is simply not doing enough. Protester Israel Harag speaking with Reuters in Tel Aviv.
He doesn't care that they'll die. He doesn't care about nothing. He cares only about continuing ruling, and he's not even ruling. He's not managing anything in Israel. Israel is in complete anarchy.
Demonstrations against Netanyahu's government aren't new in Israel. But these mass protests renewed in recent weeks after the military recovered the bodies of six hostages from Gaza. Israel and U.S.-designated terror group Hamas continue blaming each other for a lack of a ceasefire deal that would include freeing remaining hostages. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And it's not just the Houthis. Iran has a network of proxies throughout the Middle East, as well as its own military. Iran's threatening behavior toward the U.S. and Israel is one of only a few foreign policy issues addressed by presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump so far in the election campaign. VOA's Michael Lippin looks at their differing approaches.
Democratic presidential nominee and Vice President Kamala Harris has focused her relatively brief remarks about Iran on one concept, defense.
To defend our forces and our interests against Iran and Iran-backed terrorists.
In her debate with her Republican rival, former President Donald Trump, she pledged to extend that defensive approach to Israel, saying, "I will always give Israel the ability to defend itself, in particular as it relates to Iran and any threat that Iran and its proxies pose to Israel." The Biden-Harris administration helped Israel defend itself against an unprecedented aerial assault by Iran in April. It also sent warships to the region last month to deter Iran from doing so again, emphasizing that defensive approach could endear Harris to some Americans, says Michael O'Hanlon, foreign policy research director at the Brookings Institution.
I think that she knows Americans are tired of war, and certainly doesn't want to sound like she's looking for another. And so who can be against defense, right? But Americans are wary about offense. So perhaps that can be part of it, especially given the history of the last quarter century.
But the Biden-Harris administration also saw Iran's proxies escalate their aggression in August, striking U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria, and executing a U.S. hostage in Gaza. Victoria Coates, Vice President for National Security at the Heritage Foundation, says those incidents highlight a weakness in the U.S. strategy.
There has been zero retaliation from the United States. They've retained that defensive posture. My worry is that Iran is getting the message that they can continue to provoke and to escalate on their terms, and all the United States will do is respond, not take the initiative.
Trump is emphasizing his record of sanctioning Iran for its malign behavior when he was president.
I told China and other countries, if you buy from Iran, we will not let you do any business in this country, and we will put tariffs on every product you do send in of 100% or more.
In the debate, he accused the Biden-Harris administration of enriching Iran and its proxies by easing that pressure. He also promised to resolve the Iran threat, but did not elaborate, saying, "Look at what's going on in the Middle East. I will get that settled and fast." During his term, Trump engaged in a two-year-long maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Trump's avoidance of recommitting to that strategy gives him the option of pursuing a new policy that pressures Iran more quickly. One similarity between Harris and Trump is that neither of them says what they will do if Iran makes a nuclear bomb, a prospect that Iranian officials have hinted at. Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
Eight people were wounded, one critically, in Belgorod in western Russia by shelling blamed on Ukrainian forces on Monday. Dozens of residential buildings sustained damage, with windows and balconies smashed, according to the local governor. Alexei Rudenko lives in Belgorod. He said that he returned home from walking his dog about 6:30 a.m. The ground started to rumble and the building started to shake. The smell of gunpowder was very strong. Belgorod has come under frequent shelling and drone attacks from Ukraine. It's adjacent to the Kursk region, a large part of which is occupied by Ukrainian forces following a cross-border attack last month. And on the other side of Russia from Belgorod, the Russian Pacific Fleet and the Chinese Navy conducted missile and naval artillery firing exercises in the Sea of Japan. This according to the Russian Defense Ministry on Monday. The Defense Ministry also said more than 15 Russian vessels took part in the drills, including the Pacific Fleet's flagship, the missile cruiser Varyag. You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. In the wake of a new report from Congress, we'll be taking a look back at the American withdrawal from Afghanistan in a few minutes. First, though, authorities in Nairobi are trying to tackle chronic and worsening air pollution. With help from the U.S. Agency for International Development, teams are placing sensors that can monitor air quality around the densely populated city. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
Dense traffic and dirty fuel emissions characterize some of the Kenyan capital's streets. The city is home to at least 5 million people. And with the growing numbers, local authorities say the air quality is declining. Geoffrey Mosiria is the chief environment officer in Nairobi.
Many vehicles use diesel and petrol. They are emitting a lot of chemicals, the gases into the air. And also we have industries. Some of them are built in residential area.
Residents like Eunice Chuli, a vendor in Nairobi, bear the brunt of the situation. Chuli says she often falls sick. She believes it's because of the dirty air that she's exposed to here daily.
Recently, I had a coughing issue. I was coughing very seriously. I had to go to a hospital to be checked at the... Yeah, I was under medication for a whole week.
It's a situation that the authorities here are beginning to deal with. The first step is to install air quality monitors around the city. The monitors' inlets pick up particles in the air. Larger fragments are screened out, leaving the thin bits to flow to a filter. The head of air quality at the World Resources Institute, George Mwaniki, explains that the system measures particles which are usually dangerous to the human body.
And they come to a filter here where they are impacted, and then the machine has a very sensitive weighing machine that it weighs every 1 minute what is the changes in terms of the weight of the filter.
The collected data is sent out for real-time analysis. At least 37 monitors have been set up so far. The initiative is funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, for over $1.5 million. The agency's spokesperson says the data will help the government target clean air interventions where they are most needed and evaluate their effectiveness. According to a 2020 report, more than 5,000 premature deaths in Kenya are caused each year by air pollution. Respiratory disease specialist Dr. Jared Mecha says diseases that result from pollution are a matter of growing concern.
You have cough, so cough that we cannot explain. Then we also have actually cancers of the upper airway.
With the air monitoring devices, Nairobi joins 10 global cities that are working towards clean air by gathering data. Mike Saxton is the project director at Breathe Cities Initiative.
The Breathe Cities Initiative looks to take a sectoral approach, and so we're looking for innovative policies across transport, across waste management, across industry.
People interviewed by VOA say possible solutions for Nairobi include the adoption of electric vehicles, greater control of industrial emissions, and the proper collection and disposal of garbage. Researchers say political goodwill is essential to implementing any solution. Residents like Chuli hope that lasting improvements to the air quality can be found soon. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
The American withdrawal from Afghanistan just over 3 years ago is still a contentious subject inside Washington. Many Americans, including Donald Trump and his allies, blame President Joe Biden for a poorly planned and hasty retreat that resulted in death, destruction, and chaos. Meanwhile, Biden, Harris, and their allies say the blame belongs with the previous administration, that of President Trump, for negotiating with the Taliban and for accepting the terms of a deal that Biden would then have to carry out. Amadullah Arshual is a journalist with VOA's Afghan service. He spoke with John Bolton, former U.S. National Security Advisor and ambassador to the UN. They spoke about the recently released report on the withdrawal from Afghanistan by Congressman Michael McCaul and the Congressional Foreign Affairs Committee.
McCaul blamed the Biden administration for their failure in Afghanistan when they were withdrawing their troops from Afghanistan. And the Biden's administration also said that they followed whatever had been done by the previous regime. So why do they talk about it now? Because it has been 3 years almost that U.S. has left Afghanistan.
Well, I think in the case of Congressman McCaul's report, it took him time to accumulate the evidence, and the Biden administration withheld a lot of material, a lot of documentary evidence. So it just took a long time to put the report together. But the fact is, I think many in America watching the withdrawal in August of 2021 were appalled at what they saw, the chaos and the general feeling that we had left a lot of people in Afghanistan who had worked with us behind in very dangerous circumstances. It reminded some people, at least, of our withdrawal from Vietnam in the 1970s, and wasn't a very happy parallel. So it has been an issue because of the third anniversary, because the families of those who were killed, the service members who were killed at Abbey Gate, wanted some vindication for what their family member had suffered, and people just looked at the withdrawal itself as a humiliation for the United States. I think the Trump administration deserves criticism for making the deal with Taliban to begin with. That was the first mistake. Not including the government of Afghanistan in negotiations was a disastrous mistake. But also Biden, who did not have to accept the Trump administration deal with Taliban. He could have repudiated it, but he didn't. And then he carried it out, implemented it in the worst possible way. So it rubs a lot of Americans the wrong way. And I think when you're in a presidential campaign with Trump himself, who was the author of the deal, and Kamala Harris, vice president at the time of the actual withdrawal, both of these people have a lot of responsibility. A lot of blame appropriately falls on them.
Okay, so do you see any change in U.S.'s policy towards Afghanistan?
Well, I think a lot depends on the outcome of the election, which at this moment is much too close to call. I think that Trump is not likely to do much to help the opposition in Afghanistan because it reminds him too much that was his decision to withdraw in the first place that put us in the unhappy place we are now. Harris, even though she's been vice president for 3.5 years, has no visible national security experience or position. She has articulated the position of the Biden administration. And my guess is for the first year or so after she wins, she'll continue to follow that policy until she gets more comfortable as president. So therefore, a lot of this depends on views in Congress about what's right. And here, I think, as I mentioned, I think the opposition to Taliban remains strong. And I think they will be putting pressure on the new administration, whomever it is, not to give in to the Taliban. But that's an issue still to be decided.
That's VOA's Amidullah Arshiwal speaking with former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Over 5,000 people marched through Brussels, and most public transport in the Belgian capital was suspended on Monday in solidarity with the workers of Audi, whose jobs there are threatened. In July, Audi announced plans to restructure the Brussels plant, which currently employs 3,000 people, and said it was considering an early end of production for the Audi Q8 e-tron electronic cars, which are manufactured there. Workers went on strike, and although the management and union negotiators have agreed to return to work from Tuesday, the demonstration went ahead, marching to the front of the European Parliament. Union officials pointed to a wider threat to the industry. Patrick Van Bell is an official with the Socialist Union at Audi. He says that as they stand for Audi workers, they want to send a signal to European authorities and European industries. It's a similar story in India as well. Workers at a Samsung electronics factory there have gone on strike. Francis McGuire of Reuters has that story.
104 striking Samsung workers were detained by police on Monday. Officials said they were held for planning a march without permission, which they needed since there are schools, colleges and hospitals in the area. It marks an escalation of a strike at a Samsung home appliance plant near Chennai in southern India. More than 1,000 employees have boycotted work for a week. They want higher wages, better working hours, and recognition of a union backed by influential labour group, the Centre of Indian Trade Unions, or CITU. Samsung isn't keen to recognise any union backed by a national labour group like the CITU, and talks have not yet led to any agreement. The move has disrupted production that contributes roughly a third of Samsung's annual India revenue of $12 billion. Workers have protested at a makeshift tent near the plant since last week. The strike adds to Samsung's challenges in India, a key growth market. The South Korean company plans job cuts of up to 30% of its overseas staff in some divisions, including in India. India's antitrust body has also found Samsung and other smartphone companies violated competition laws by colluding with e-commerce giants to launch devices exclusively. Samsung did not respond to a request for comments on Monday. But on Friday, the firm said it had initiated discussions with workers at the Chennai plant to resolve all issues at the earliest. The Samsung protests have cast a doubt on Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's plan of courting foreign investors to make in India. He also aims to triple electronics production to $500 billion in 6 years.
That's Francis McGuire of Reuters reporting for us today. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.